Mumbai-based billionaires, people like Mahindra, Anand Mahindra, people like, you know, Steel Mittal, Lakshmi Mittal, Ajay Priramal, Tata's, Bajaj, these kind of people, are funding this very project in Harvard. Dalits are the blacks of India, and non-Dalits are the whites of India. And caste is racism, basically, same as racism. And therefore, the American laws on racism should be applied to caste. This is legally happening. Lawsuits are being filed in the United States. Laws that don't have the word caste in them, don't have the word Dalit or any of that in them, that have the word white and black, are being applied to Indians in the United States. And it'll come to India, I'll tell you later, shortly. Their idea of our society, their idea of Hinduism, their idea of their interpretation of Vedas, their interpretation of Sanskrit, which is not correct, which is not, it is a Marxist interpretation. Their interpretation of what is wrong with politics, is India a democracy, is it a sham democracy, are we exploiting, you know, different kinds of communities. All of this nonsense that Jaishankar and your media here and there talk about and get angry, it is coming from this root cause. And unless you know the root cause, you are just reacting to the symptoms. It's like you go to a doctor, and if he's not good, he'll just treat one symptom and say, okay, you have a cold, take this, go away. But a good doctor will go to the root cause. He'll want to know, why is it happening? Why are you having many episodes? Why? What is wrong inside, deep? So I'm giving you the root cause. I'm telling you what is the root cause. And our Ministry of External Affairs only firefighting at the symptom level.
Decades ago, you had the Black Panther movement, which was clearly considered a terrorist organization in the US. And in India, you have a Dalit Panther movement as well. So these are at the activism level. Now, Yengde is also developing history and scholarship to establish these things in terms of the narratives of Dalit lives, Dalit history, things like that, which will be published in publications, journals, where our articles will never be allowed. When you talk to Nicole Hannah-Jones and say, hey, these are some problems and inaccuracies, so many historians have said this is not correct, they immediately say that, oh, this is not history, but this is more like opinion-based journalism. So they move the goalpost and say, we're really not writing history, but we're doing journalism. Now, this entire 1619 project was funded by the Pulitzer Center. And Harvard has close ties to the Pulitzer Center. Now, a similar project funded by the Pulitzer Center is being done in India, and we don't know about it. It's called the People's Archive of Rural India.
A very good morning to all of you. As you would have all noticed, we generally spend very little time in introducing our speakers. That is in part due to the very vast proliferation of information, and in part, or mainly, because of the very fact that our speakers are extremely well known. But yet, as a formality, Rajivji has already done 3 programs in Mumbai. And yet we have such a big audience here, so that probably talks about his introduction, first of all. Second, he's a graduate from St. Stephen's, Delhi, a postgraduate from Syracuse, an infotech entrepreneur. He started the Infinity Foundation in 1994 and has since been an extremely prolific writer, researcher, and a public intellectual. Welcome, Rajivji. Vijayaji is an engineer, an MBA from Wharton, followed by an extremely successful global corporate career, after which she turned her focus to education. Today, she is a fellow director of Rajivji on the Infinity Foundation board, and she has also co-authored their latest book, Snakes in the Ganga. A resurgent India looking to establish its place in the global peers, helped by a buoyant economy and probably one of the best COVID recoveries, also faces an enormous pushback and challenges from the established order. Will Bharat get its much-deserved place in the new global order? Or will the forces inimical to its rise derail that? Are global and local institutes of educational excellence going to aid that or stymie it? And as India faces these challenges, it's worth understanding if there is a greater agenda behind such concerted efforts to divide India, particularly using caste as a potent weapon. Who better than our speakers of today, who have just written a very, very good book? First, Rajiv Ji will address us, followed by that, Vijaya Ji will address us. And then, like always, we will take question and answers. And a word of caution, as you all know, we ask you to submit written Q&A because we do screen the questions for appropriateness, how they add to the discussion, and for the overall relevance. So please do hand over your questions to our volunteers in the aisles. Rajiv Ji and Vijaya Ji, over to you.
Namaste. It's indeed an honor to be here and address such a large gathering. I think I was just telling them this morning that Maharashtra is one of the, probably the most interesting place for discussions of the type I like to have, because people are so engaged and so interested and so lively, and a lot of intellectual activity here. I spent 24 hours in Pune. I wish I had spent 1 week because there's so much. And even in Mumbai, there's so much more we could do. And we should be coming back more and spending more time here. In the allotted time, Vijay and I will divide the time and discuss with you our latest findings. It's often unfortunate that the people who are considered intellectuals in our community are basically recycling new information using old paradigms, old frameworks. Some of these frameworks, for instance, in the book Breaking India, are 10, 15 years old. Things have changed. We need to create a new framework because the rest of the world has moved forward. The Kurukshetra is not like it was even 5 years ago. So if you haven't updated your framework, then you are trying to process and make sense of the new episodes. Maybe it's a BBC documentary, maybe something happened in Wall Street Journal, maybe something happened in Geneva. So new things happening. And if you're trying to make sense of it in the old framework, it won't make sense. All you can do is chase each episode, like with the fire extinguisher. Our Jay Shankar, nice guy, very capable, goes around putting out this fire, putting out that fire. But you need to figure out what's the root cause. And I don't think people have figured out in India what is the root cause. And this is where we have done our research. So we are going to present things that are new and provocative. Even to those, and especially to those who are considered intellectuals, established intellectuals, because they're not talking about these things. And you can disagree. We are more than happy. We're used to it. And we like the back and forth as long as it's relevant and respectful. So to frame my discussion on this new book, Snakes in the Ganga, I'm going to give you a list of what are provocative statements and provocative conclusions we have reached in this book, and then I'll elaborate later. Each one of them leads to the next. They follow in sequence, and some of them are very theoretical, but you will see how they apply to the ground reality. From the theoretical, if you understand the theoretical framework, you will understand the ground reality better. Some of them are causing other effects. So they're all interrelated. So I'm going to give you a quick list of what we will talk about. Surprise number one is what I call the Americanization of Marxism. Marxism is considered to be something that happened in Europe, and you think of it in Soviet Union and North Korea and China and all that. America is the last place you expect to be Marxist because it is the most anti-communist kind of place. But I will tell you, the Marxism has been Americanized. And this is chapter one of this book. It's a very big story, I will tell you. The second surprise theory, theoretical framework, is the Indianization of racism, Indianization of American racism. We have jati, we have varna, we have caste, we have many kinds of ways of dividing people, and there is bias here, there, or all that is true, but it is not the same thing as racism. But this has happened now, that American racism has been superimposed to understand Indian society. And so this Marxism has become Americanized and applied to race. And this new theory, which is called critical race theory, is now being Indianized through caste. So these two are a framework that has not been properly appreciated in India. And therefore, all the things that are happening in foreign countries and what they are bringing here, how they're attacking us, or what is going on in Ashoka University, in Kriya University, in TIS, in all kind of places, you know, people don't know, they don't know what to make of it. And they think it's an isolated instance here and there. So these are the two first surprises. Surprise number three is the impact of all of this theoretical framework on Indians in the United States and Indians in India, both of them, how they are being impacted and how this impact is going to get pretty bad very soon. So you should be prepared for more things to come, and we'll tell you how to combat them, how to face them. That is surprise number three, is the relevance to India in ground reality, not theoretical, but actual affecting your industry, your jobs, your education, etc. Surprise number four is that the headquarters where this theoretical framework has been formulated and from where it is being exported worldwide, especially to India, and all these applications which are harmful to India, happens to be Harvard University. That's a surprise, because people don't think that, wow, Harvard, they are so great, they produce Nobel laureates, they have scientists, but we are not talking about science, technology, engineering, medicine, for which Harvard is very good. All these places are extreme. We're talking about social sciences. We're talking about their study of Indian history, Indian politics, Indian social thought, Indian, you know, social justice, human rights. This is very big there. And India is the big target. So we are talking about that. So that is surprise number four, that Harvard is this place. Surprise number five is that your Mumbai-based billionaires, people like Mahindra, Anand Mahindra, people like, you know, Steel Mittal, Lakshmi Mittal, Ajay Priramal, Tata's, Bajaj, these kind of people, are funding this very project in Harvard. This is a very big surprise. You have to know this. And you can ask me questions. We'll give you the data. We have a big book with full of data. So you see, there is a theory, how it's impacting Indians, who is behind it, and then who are the people funding it. Someone asked me, do you think that, are you calling people like Mahindra snakes? And I said, no, but they're feeding the snakes. And they may be snake charmers, but they're not the snakes. The snakes are other people we'll talk about. But they're sort of facilitating, maybe foolishly, maybe intentionally. We'll talk about it. So that is surprise number five. And then finally, how does it affect Indian society? How deep is this cancer? Is it in the government? Yes. Is it in the education ministry? Yes. Is it in the think tanks? Yes. Is it in the American consultants who've come here to teach you ESG and diversity, equity, inclusion, and corporate and policies on, you know, NEP policies? Yes. So these are the six major points I'm going to put on the table one by one. Not necessarily in this chronology. They'll also be a little bit mixed up back and forth because they're related. I will make some points. Vijaya will continue, complete, and the two of us will want to convey this to you. So the Americanization of Marxism. Marxism in its original form is a theory of exploiter, exploited, oppressor, oppressed, using economic classes only, not religion, not race. Marx was very clear. Only the people who own the economic means of production are oppressing those who are the laborers. This is Marxism. And then in Germany, in the late next century, Marxism started in the 1800s. So in the middle 1900s, during World War II, they came up with something called the Second Wave. Frankfurt School is another name. Cultural Marxism is another name. And they came up with this theory that now, we, rather than talking only about economic classes, we are talking about how culture, how narrative can be used for exploitation. So according to them, if you were to apply it today, all the movie industry, all the popular culture industry, education system, all the parades, all the symbols, all the religious icons, all that is a sort of cultural Marxism. A cultural Marxism works on that and says that people are being exploited because of this. So that's cultural Marxism. Then there is a third wave. I'm calling it third wave, but the Marxists called it first wave, second wave. Third wave is when somebody called Herbert Marcuse, a well-known Austrian German from that part of the Europe, Marxist, he comes to Berkeley, and some other Marxists from Germany come to Columbia University, and they realize that to make Marxism work in America, they have to apply it to race, because they realize that Americans are not going to accept this economic stratification, economic exploitation, because it's a free market. But there is racism, so that's a way to get in. So they applied Marxism to racism, and the exploiter exploited our race, one race exploiting another. So this took a few years, a few decades to become mainstream. Recently, in the last 10 years, it became very mainstream. It's called critical race theory. And critical race theory says that, using Marxist ideas, that all the structures made by white people are meant to abuse black people and Hispanics. And by the way, Muslims joined in and said, we are also minority, we also are exploited in America. Imagine in 9/11, just 20 years ago, Muslims were on the run in America. So much against them, everybody, that you guys have done all this. They have repositioned the whole discourse by aligning with the left and saying this critical race theory also should apply to religion. So now critical race theory is applied to race and religion. So the exploited, according to this, are Muslims, are blacks, are Hispanics, are Native Americans, LGBTQ also joined in. And so the exploiters are the whites and others they are associated with. And the demolishing all their structures is very necessary. This is the theory. Now this is the Americanization of Marxism. Now comes the Indianization of race. That's a new idea. You will say, why? What does that have to do with us? So now there is a whole movement which says that Dalits are the blacks of India and non-Dalits are the whites of India. And caste is racism, basically, same as racism. And therefore, the American laws on racism should be applied to caste. This is legally happening. Lawsuits are being filed in the United States. Laws that don't have the word caste in them, don't have the word Dalit or any of that in them, that have the word white and black, are being applied to Indians in the United States, and it'll come to India, I'll tell you later, shortly. These laws are being, and policies in the corporate world and the universities and so on, are being applied to caste and Indians because of this Indianization of racism, meaning that racism as understood in America is the way to characterize Indian society. Indian society is also one race versus another, except they are called caste. Caste is just another name, but it is racism. So the person who wrote this book, Wilkerson, is a Pulitzer Prize winner, number one New York Times bestseller, very much on the Oprah show, became Oprah Book of the Month, very much felicitated all over the place. And now I'll tell you the Harvard angle. There is one Ajanta Subramaniam, Indian, professor at Harvard, who wrote this book that meritocracy in place in the tech and in IITs and generally in tech. Meritocracy is actually casteism only. Basically, this idea that it is based on merit is a sham. There is a caste privilege, and those who are the oppressor caste are calling it merit. And so even though they have exams and all of that stuff, the real fact is that that is not really true. What is, it's all a sham. But the caste oppression is now being called merit to make it look nice. So this business of turning Indian society into a sham meritocracy is a very serious consequence. Now there are people calling for H-1B visa should be given based on caste quotas. Some people are calling that. There is a Suraj Yengde, a Dalit, who's become the big poster boy at Harvard Kennedy School. He's become popular there. He's been brought there for many years, and he's into this this identity called Afro-Dalit. Afro-Dalit, African Dalit hyphenated. The Dalits are African-American, bye-bye. And the non-Dalits are whites. This is a very strange thing. It puts us in an awkward position. So then there are people who have taken this idea, Indians, someone called Sondarya Rajan in New York, who says that she has done survey of Indian workers in the United States, starting in tech industry and various other places. And she has concluded that racism among Indians based on caste is as bad or worse than the racism that whites have over blacks. This is her conclusion. And this report went viral. It has been covered in all the newspapers, all everything from Washington Post and New York Times and Wall Street Journal and BBC. They all covered it because the whole ecosystem that looking for this kind of idea. So now with all of this work done, coming from Harvard, all this was published by Harvard University Press, the world's most powerful, well-known press, academic press. This is now the syllabus. They're teaching this for many years. This is being spread into all the universities elsewhere. Journalists are being trained. So this is the Harvard role in producing all of this material. And now they filed a lawsuit against Silicon Valley companies that are hiring a lot of Brahmins, saying that this is white supremacy. The first case was filed against Cisco. Cisco, as you know, is a very big tech company in Silicon Valley, which has tens of thousands of Indians. And though the Cisco defended it, and the poor fellow who's the Brahmin picked as a target, considered to be white supremacist and so on, he's called me and we've talked and he's in trouble and he wants to have help and whatnot. So, of course, Indian consulate not helping them. They want to stay out of it. Arey bhai, hamara kya hoga? We don't want to do it. None of the gurus have come out and helped him. So, you know, the people who are always championing, hum bahut great hai, hum vishwa guru ban jayenge, ye wo, when the time comes, they're not there to help. Okay? So then these consultants who have come up with this theory that Indians are caste, racist, Indian caste is equivalent to racism, they have gone to all the Silicon Valley companies, started offering workshops called caste sensitivity training. So they went to Microsoft and somebody called me up later and said that this Satya Nadella, the top guy, was there attending this meeting, briefing for several hours on caste workshop, where they're telling you all this nonsense about the history of Vedas and caste and exploitation and lacks of caste, Dalits have been killed and all this going on. Very horrible stuff. And this person tells me that it was very embarrassing that I'm sitting there in front of all my American colleagues and they're looking at me saying, maybe this is what they're saying about you. But we were advised not to answer, not to raise questions, because then we'll be accused of being in denial. And then we'll be more targeted. So the Indians are scared to talk back because they have been told to just sit quietly, listen. So then I got similar calls from people in Facebook and on, PayPal, many companies, saying that this is going around everywhere. And now we are being told that you are casteist and racist people. So we are on the defensive. Anyone who is jealous of us, they've got a way to get even. Anyone who thinks that we are doing too well in America, we're taking away the jobs from the whites. Now they can blame us for this. So this has become a very serious problem. And many municipalities, starting with Seattle and many others, have passed ordinances classifying Hindu caste as a form of racism. This is the new thing there. Harvard has, and all the universities have followed suit. And the legal discourse is following suit. And don't think that this is not relevant in India, because your Justice Chandrachud quotes all this as his philosophy. He quotes all the Harvard guys, he quotes critical race theory, he quotes all of this rhetoric that has come from Harvard. He quotes Harvard people saying that this is coming from them, and he's adhering to it. So it is coming to the judiciary. It is also coming through the corporate sector in India, because the Microsofts of all these different companies in the United States, not just tech, but automobile, banking, pharmaceutical, all these industries, they are putting this into their DEI department, diversity, equity, inclusion departments. And then these DEI departments from the headquarters are transferring it to their subsidiaries all over India. So Microsoft India, Google, Apple, all these are going to have similar policies in India for their employees. And they're also applying it to their outsourcing clients. So TCS and all these kind of places, Infosys and Mahindra's outsourcing, they'll all be subject to the similar kind of things. This means that now casteism, defined by American law, implemented in American corporates, is going to be imposed on Indians. We will be told what is caste and what is right and what is wrong by Americans telling us what is caste and what is wrong with it, based on putting their racism into it as the framework. This is pretty serious, which means that we're bad enough with caste problems here. Now it's going to be the Americanization of caste idea on us. So these are some of the serious problems we've raised in this book. We've given evidence. Now comes the next part, the next surprise, which is that there is a chapter called Mahindra Humanities Center at Harvard in our book. And there is one called Lakshmi Mittal and Family Center for South Asia Studies at Harvard, whole chapter on it. There's another chapter on Piramal Public Health at Harvard. Now, all these people have invested tens of millions of dollars setting up, you know, organizations in Harvard with their name, their family name. And whether they realize it or not, I don't know. But you look at the director of the Mahindra Humanities Center. He's a well-known, world-famous, anti-Hindu, anti-national person who gives interviews, who's written about it all during his life. It's no secret. People tell me, "Are bhaiya, why are you naming them?" I said, "I'm not naming them, they name themselves." When they have a seminar, the big thing in the backdrop is Mahindra Humanities Center, and this is what they're talking. When they have a South Asia conference at Lakshmi Mittal, it says Lakshmi Mittal Center for South Asia Studies. It says in the backdrop, it says in the invitation, it says on their website, and they're talking these things. So they're bringing Khalistanis, they're bringing Kashmir separatists, they're bringing Dalit activists, they're bringing in, some ultra-feminists who are saying women are exploited here. All this sort of stuff is being churned now in Harvard with our own billionaires' money and their name. So previously when I wrote this Breaking India book a dozen years ago and started talking about it 10 years before that, that was not involving Harvard. It was not involving billionaires. It was not involving the elite. These are elites being involved, not the grassroots. Breaking India earlier was villages, poor people, not educated people, being exploited with these ideas, with ideas like Christianity and Marxism and Dravidianism. That was at the bottom of the pyramid, if you will, social, political, economic pyramid, the bottom, being exploited. But now, this is Breaking India 2.0. It's different. The reason it's different is that now the attack is at the top of the elites. They've captured this billionaire's money, their corporate institutions, HR departments, bringing in DEI officers who are giving seminars on all these, diversity and equity and all that. They are doing that. And this is coming to places like Ashoka University is now this center in India, and Kriya, and Godrej Labs, and Azim Premji. They've all brought these ideas into India. So now this is coming through the elites. And these people are also from Harvard and so on. Some of them are advisors in Niti Aayog. Some of them have had a lot of influence in development of NEP. Now, what is wrong with NEP is not about STEM. STEM is good. They have got good ideas on promoting science, technology, you know, all of that. That's very good. Problem is, when they talk about promoting liberal arts, they're not promoting Vedic liberal arts. There is no program to even create Vedic social sciences. No program like that. In Delhi, I've given talks, asked some of our best thinkers who are going around giving talk here, there, and they're well known to all of you. They have written book here and there. I've said, any of you working on Vedic social sciences, and they either don't know what it means or they come up with, we had Pushpak Viman and we had this and that. That's not what we're talking about. We need a discipline called social sciences from the Vedic point of view, because Vedas have a lot to say about society, how society is organized. That has not started even. So we are not even at the beginning of creating our own alternative discourse. And NEP 2020 says open the floodgates for liberal arts. Guess whose liberal arts are coming in? It's all this Harvard liberal arts. It's all this, their idea of our society, their idea of Hinduism, their idea of their interpretation of Vedas, their interpretation of Sanskrit, which is not correct, which is not, it is a Marxist interpretation. Their interpretation of what is wrong with politics, is India a democracy, is it a sham democracy, are we exploiting, you know, different kinds of communities. All of this nonsense that Jai Shankar and your media here and there talk about and get angry, it is coming from this root cause. And unless you know the root cause, you are just reacting to the symptoms. It's like you go to a doctor, and if he's not good, he'll just treat one symptom and say, okay, you have a cold, take this, go away. But a good doctor will go to the root cause. He'll want to know, why is it happening? Why are you having many episodes? Why? What is wrong inside, deep? So I'm giving you the root cause. I'm telling you what is the root cause. And our Ministry of External Affairs only firefighting at the symptom level. And Hindus who are saying we are Hindus, we are right wing, whatever it is, whatever the labeling is, I'm not too crazy about labeling. Whoever these people are who are the keepers of Bharat and, you know, nice slogans, Bharat first and this and that, and Manthan and Book Lakhliya and a lot of people into YouTube, none of them have identified either the Americanization of Marxism or the Indianization of American racism or how this has happened in America facing the diaspora and then being exported back to India through the corporate sector. None of them have done this. None of them have identified Harvard as a cause. None of them have identified Indian billionaires as a funding it. So if these five or six major things are not even identified, then these people who are going around talking are 10 years obsolete. 10 years obsolete in diagnosing the disease. Ye nahi bimari hai. It's not the same virus like before. And only if you understand how it works, can you have a chance to do something about it. You can't just go on saying, aapko wohi zukam hai jo pehle hota tha, and you can't treat it the same way. It's something new. So same way, what I'm talking about is a new bimari. It's a new kind of intellectual disease, if you will, in terms of social sciences, how the social sciences have been distorted and exported to India. Now, the irony is, India is the most diverse place in the world. India does not need a lecture on diversity. We do not need Harvard to come up with a theory of diversity, teach it to the American corporates through the Harvard Business School and Harvard Kennedy School, and then have those corporates come up with DEI indexes and DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, training, and then bring it to India. But we have, the sad thing is, all over Bombay, they have these HR departments. The fashionable thing is to have these Western ideas come in and give lecture on ESG. ESG is environment, societal, and governance. And the S part of ESG is all about diversity, equity, inclusion. And in every HR department, there is an officer in charge of diversity, equity, inclusion. These people are not trained with the Vedic idea or our idea of what is diversity and what is inclusion. And we have a very old tradition, very deep tradition. They are trained in the Harvard and the Western idea of what is diversity, which is their idea solving their problem. They have different problem, different history, but that doesn't apply to us. We are creating a problem that doesn't exist. We are creating a problem that America has by accepting their idea about us. We are creating a problem which doesn't exist, and we are trying to solve a problem which is an American problem. It is not our problem. We have problems. We are not a perfect society. I'm not chauvinistic, but our problem is different. It's like I have a disease, but it is not the same disease you have. So don't give me your medicine. That's the point I'm making. So this business of bringing a wholesale, this critical race theory, also called wokeism, into India and applying it to our society through, there are three paths being used mainly. It's not through church. That is old other problem. These three paths are, first, corporate sector. I told you about it. They're bringing it in the form of policies. They come up with this index of pluralism, who has got more religious freedom, as if they are the authorities on religious freedom, as if we don't know and we need to be coached. Who has more, you know, what is happiness index, what is index for diversity. Diversity is a very big index nowadays. So they are coming up with these indexes, and they are training people in India, giving them certification, and they, with the certification you can get a job. So Indians are very happy, young people getting trained in this, you see. And they are, this kind of consulting is being done by who? Ernst & Young, McKinsey, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Deloitte, etc. It's a huge industry for them to come and talk to some corporate, do an audit, tell them what is wrong, where they are on this index, how to get better. This is a new form of kind of colonization. And our people lapping it up, like, must be having an inferiority complex, our industrialists, but lapping it up. Our IIMs lapping it up as sort of a new theory of management that they should be teaching. Not realizing that this is a form of colonization, this is a form of our own social structures being hijacked. Now, if you understand all this, you will now understand why there was this dismantling Hindutva conference. Otherwise, you wonder, kya kiya, kyon kiya, kaun kar raha tha, who knows, what is the relationship between that and some BBC story, something here, there. These are not independent, isolated things happening here and there. You cannot fight it by putting out one fire. You have to look at the root cause. And sorry to tell you, my friends, our people, neither the ones in Mumbai nor the ones in Delhi looking at the government or anywhere, have really started looking at this seriously, which is why we wrote this book. It is not an easy thing to write, because we'll be attacked, we know, but this has to be done. And so the first point of entry into India is the corporate. Second is government. Delhi is infested with these kind of consultants and these kind of people inside our government. We have some advisors in the Niti Aayog, we have advisors in HRD. So one of the fields I'm in is artificial intelligence, so I'm very concerned about the theft of Indian data, big data being siphoned off, a lot of data mining going on, which is very dangerous for us. But guess who is writing these policies for India? The Niti Aayog publishes, but who is actually writing and whom are they quoting? It is these American consulting companies. If you look at the Indian policy on AI and this big white paper, strategic planning, whatnot. If you look in the back, where are the footnotes, endnotes, where is the data coming from? It's all coming from these Western, it has not been sourced from within. So our thinking is also like we are becoming we are a consumer of this kind of a thinking. This is the second point of entry, government. First, I mentioned, is business, then government. The third is tech people in Bangalore. We have a huge invasion by people like, for instance, Pierre Omidyar. Many of you know of Soros and you think he's a bad guy. He is, but he's in his 80s. But Omidyar has got many times more billions. And I call him Soros 2.0. And he's half the age, and he's very tech savvy. He's a technocrat. He knows artificial intelligence. He knows how to. So he's invested over $500 million in India. They are open about it. They have about 200 ventures, startups. So they are investing in startups where they get data from the startup. They're developing services which will create almost like a parallel government in the villages. How to help the ordinary citizen get services from the government without going to the Sarkari office directly, but going through them. So they keep track and they keep some power. They become a power broker. And also they're doing training on social justice. So whenever you see words like social justice, human rights, you have to say, aha, there's something going on. It's not what we normally think of as social justice. There's some agenda there, because that's the terminology under which they like to have intervention. So this is a serious matter. Now this book, Snakes in the Ganga, which is available outside, and we'll be happy to sign copies if whoever wants us to, we'll be happy. This is looks scary because very big, but you, if you read the first chapter, the lead introduction, which is 50-page summary of everything I've said, that's very important. And then each of the 22 chapters, there's a one-page summary at the beginning. It's called overview. So if you read the overview of every chapter, all 22 of them, then in less than 100 pages, you will know what the book says. What the book says in great detail. And then the rest of the pages, every chapter, you can read if you want proof. You want exact evidence of what I'm saying. Or you get into a discussion or an argument with somebody, and they're asking, well, proof karo kya hai? When you are saying, Mahindra ye wo kar raha hai, kya kar raha hai, dikhao. So you have evidence of what his people are saying. So the book is big, but you can read it at leisure. Only read 100 pages, the introduction and the overview. Read that, and you will have enough working knowledge to talk about it, discuss it, take it out, put some pressure on the industrialists, put some pressure on the government, put some pressure on our so-called thinkers who are not doing original thinking. They are not discovering these things. They're just recycling same ideas that we've been talking about for 10 years. So I urge you to do that. And now there are a couple of other books I should talk about. One is called Battle for IITs. That is written to expose the attack on Indian meritocracy in the tech industry. Not just IITs, but in the tech industry, there is a attack on meritocracy that says Indian institutions should be dismantled because they are a form of racism, they're casteism, oppressing the Dalits, and they are structurally biased. From the exam to the coaching to the classes to social life, all that is inherently biased and it has to be dismantled. It's a pretty serious allegation. And this means that people who are graduates from these institutions, when they go looking for jobs, they will be branded and stereotyped and stigmatized as, you know, bad people. I haven't done anything wrong. You tell me what I've done wrong. I just happen to be from a certain institution and a certain family background. That's not my fault. But that's how it's happening. Another book we have is called Varna Jati Caste. Varna Jati Caste. Which is to give people our response to all this. To explain the history of all this from the Vedic time, Varna system, what it was not, how it's been misinterpreted. Jati system, how it becomes caste only in recent centuries when the Europeans come. And the whole history, there's a Shudra dynasty, the whole history of dynamic flow, fluidity among the different communities in India. Even now, you know, the fluidity in many places. But there is exploitation. There is no doubt there is social exploitation like there is in every country. China has this with the Uyghurs, Muslims, and the Tibetans, etc. Americans have it, French have it. Every country in the world has this, some stratification, okay? But that stratification cannot be blamed on the Vedas and told, okay, now we have to dismantle the Vedas. That is what this Hindutva, dismantling Hindutva conference was all about. Dismantle the Vedas, because that is the source of all these problems. I mean, we have exploitation, hierarchy based on Angreziyat. English language is a source of hierarchy. There's an English language caste system. Those who know English get better jobs. And depending on your accent and depending on how much English you know, it determines your job credentials. The bias in the workplace is not that some Brahmins know Sanskrit better and therefore they got preference. Nobody gets preference based on Sanskrit. But people do get preference based on English. So the criteria for exploitation and stratification is very different today than it used to be. So maybe we need quota for people who come from non-English background, from quota for them. That they are the subjugated caste or some kind of thing, you know, that they have a disadvantage. And so corporate should be required to reserve X percent of seats for non-English speaking so that these people are smart. They are educated. In their own language, they're educated. What's wrong? Why couldn't they get a job? So this opens up many conversations that we should have, this book, Varna Jati Caste. Then another book we have, these are all we've come up with in the last 6 months, these books. Another book we have is called 10 Heads of Ravan. Now, 10 Heads of Ravan is a book where we are mentoring new scholars, we call them intellectual kshatriyas. And so the last 3-4 years, I've mentored these people to write one article on each of the 10 heads of Ravan. So what do we mean by 10 heads of Ravan? What we are saying is that Ravan has become reincarnated now as an intellectual. So this intellectual Ravan has got 10 personalities. And we are taking each one of them and doing one article critiquing them. So there's heads of Ravan include Romila Thapar, Irfan Habib, Shashi Tharoor, Devdutt Patnaik, people like that. And also Westerners, Wendy Doniger, Audrey Truscay, Sheldon Pollack, these kind of people. So these 10 heads are the 10 intellectual personalities of Ravan that need to be critiqued. We made it clear to our team, no emotions required or allowed. Nothing, no insult allowed. You're not going to take something personal. Only write about their work. So each person, when you are targeting a particular head of Ravan, you have to read hundreds of pages, thousands of pages about that person and what they have written only. Mark out what you think is wrong, biased, incorrect, factually incorrect, and quote it exact where they wrote it, page number, which book, whatever, and then give your rebuttal, your response, give your argument, but no hitting below the belt, no defamation, nothing. So we are not allowed to say if accused that this person murdered his wife or something like that. We're not allowed to say like that. We can only criticize their written work, what they have written. We can criticize that, but we are not attacking anybody personally. This is important. So we just launched this book in Delhi 3-4 weeks ago, and we invited all those 10 people to come. And we sent them the chapter about them and said, this is what we have written about you. You come, agree, disagree. We'll be neutral, moderator. You will be, there's no insulting. It'll be respectful. This is what somebody says. You can argue. You will be allowed. Nobody will censor you. Nobody will block you. We want to have a good, honest conversation with you on camera. Not one of them came. Yeah. So you see, we did not cancel them, but they canceled themselves. This is the strange thing. So this is how we are creating our young team. Because I'm 72, I got to now realize that I have another 20 books to finish. That's my promise. I have to finish because I've started that research long ago. So much work has been done which has never been published. And it's all very new, original, important things. I have to get them out two, three books a year as fast as I can. And then I have to train a team to take over. And this is what I'm basically doing right now. So I thank you for listening, and I'll invite Vidya to come and give you more stuff, more details on this, and then we'll be happy to take Q&A. Thank you very much.
Namaskar. Thank you for this opportunity, and I'd like to take off on where Rajivji left off. Rajivji spoke about the Afro Dalit project. In the book Snakes in the Ganga, there's one chapter that we have dedicated to this idea, and the scholar in question is one Suraj Yengede from Maharashtra. And Yengede is the poster boy for the Dalit cause, according to Harvard. So Yengede, his job at Harvard is to establish this narrative that the Dalits are indeed the blacks of India. So how does one do that? So Yengide has meticulously got resources to meticulously map the African-American experience from a racial standpoint into the Dalit experience. So how do you do that? You have, at a superficial level, you have Black History Month that's celebrated in February in America. So you have Dalit History Month. It's benign. And yes, we should celebrate. Nothing wrong with that. And then you have Black Lives Matter, which more and more in the US is seeming like an extreme organization prone to violence. Now you have, you know, Dalit Lives Matter is also a movement that has started. Now, decades ago, you had the Black Panther movement, which was clearly considered a terrorist organization in the US. And in India, you have a Dalit Panther movement as well. So these are at the activism level. Now, Yengide is also developing history and scholarship to establish these things in terms of the narratives of Dalit lives, Dalit history, things like that, which will be published in publications, journals, where our articles will never be allowed, but that would be the body of literature which other scholars will refer to in the future. So that's going on. Now, an interesting project that happened a couple of years ago in the US is called the 1619 Project. A woman by the name of Nicole Hannah Jones, she won the Pulitzer Prize, and she essentially came up with an anthology, a series of articles on how the founding of America essentially was not 1776, but actually 1619, when the first group of 20 slaves, African-American slaves came, African slaves landed in Virginia, in the Virginia colony. And therefore, that should be the founding of America. And she goes on to establish that the entire American excellence and prosperity is out of slave trade. While there could be some truth to this, many on the other side say that that's not the case. The South did not make America prosperous necessarily, and there was a cost to having slavery. And so America is very divided, because the 1619 Project is rewriting American history. What used to be in the footnote of history textbooks is now the main text. And the rest of American history, like Lincoln, Jefferson, you know, the pillars of American independence have all been marginalized, so to speak, in the history textbook, in the 1619 Project. The 1619 Project now is taught in all K-12 schools as the main history narrative. Now, when you talk to Nicole Hannah Jones and say, hey, these are some problems and inaccuracies, so many historians have said this is not correct, they immediately say that, oh, this is not history, but this is more like opinion-based journalism. So they move the goalpost and say, we're really not writing history, but we're doing journalism. Now, this entire 1619 Project was funded by the Pulitzer Center. And Harvard has close ties to the Pulitzer Center. Now, a similar project funded by the Pulitzer Center is being done in India, and we don't know about it. It's called the People's Archive of Rural India. Now, it's a very interesting project. It's got a lot of funding. From the website, you can tell that it's a well put together website. And the goal is to let the Dalits and the tribals and ordinary people write their history. Well, that seems like an interesting idea. And yes, these voices should be heard. In the age of AI, you can see where this can very easily go. Now, this People Archives of Rural India, PARI as it's called, we've featured that in the book, is the 1619 Project equivalent of India. And again, this is funded by the Pulitzer Center. An ex-editor of The Hindu is running it. It's also funded by a person by the name of Neville Roy Singham, who is an American citizen, with close ties to the CCP. Now, he's on the watch list in America because he is a mouthpiece and he does the propaganda work for the CCP in the US. So he has been sort of on the watch list. I think a year ago, even in India, he got into trouble with some finance dealing within India and is also on the watch list in India. Now, Neville Roy Singham has established contacts with the CCP. And Neville Roy Singham is a guy who's running this project in India. Yeah, so you can question the motives of this. So these are national security issues that we should address. So this is how the narrative of Dalits being the blacks of India is being established very systematically at all levels. We have at a popular level with Black Lives Matter, Dalit Lives Matter, Dalit History Month, and then you have People's Archives suddenly rewriting history that the entire history of India and the wealth that India had was from Dalit blood, just like how America was built on African American sweat and blood. So these are sort of the parallels that's happening. Now Suraj Yengede wants the government to send 10,000 Dalit students every year and sponsor their education at Harvard. Suraj Yengede wants reparations, that all free land should be given to the Dalits. So these are sort of the ideas where this thing is heading. Yeah, this is where this is heading. It's all ending in reparations. So that is one part of how critical race theory as critical caste theory manifests in India. Now the other part where critical race theory is used is in the gender ideology side. Now, Ashoka University is sort of the center for this, bringing in Western ideas of gender and sexuality into Indian education system. A person by the name of Harshbeen Zaveri, she's the CEO of NRB Bearings, a Mumbaiite, a big business leader. She is from Wellesley College, and she's also a donor at Wellesley College, it's a small liberal arts college in the US, and Ashoka University. Now, she funds this whole program to bring in Western scholarship on gender and sexuality studies into Ashoka. Now, gender studies and sexuality studies are very, very controversial, even in the West. You have youngsters that are totally confused on their gender identity. This whole business of the trans movement, where young girls as young as 14, 15 years are having bilateral mastectomy to become men, and they don't even have to ask their parents for permission. So 14-year-old girls have going through this body mutilating surgeries, and this has become a very divisive issue in the US, because even to vote or to have alcohol you need to be much older, whereas to chop off your breasts at the age of 14 or 15 you don't need any permission. And this is all coming to India as well, and Ashoka is sort of the center. And I bring the NRB Bearings CEO into the picture because Rajivji's talked about Mittal and Mahindra, but there are tons of other people. It's like a mall where you have some anchor investors, and in between you have some other smaller retail shops. So who are giving 5 million, 10 million, not the 50 and 100 million, but who are giving smaller amounts of money, still big for us, but in the larger scheme of things. So this gender ideology comes to Ashoka. So what does it mean? So Ashoka has these conferences on gender and sexuality. They're very happy. They're very, very proud of the fact that, the head says that throughout India, we have only gender studies, but Ashoka is the first one that has gender and sexuality studies. It is something big. And what kind of sexuality are we talking about? It's not about safe sex or sexual health, none of that. It is about pushing boundaries. It is about breaking norms. So what would that mean? They think pornography is an essential part of education. We should bring it to children and teach them about pornography, because pornography breaks structures, right? Who is to say that children should, for example, there's an attack on childhood innocence. because they say childhood innocence itself is something that the patriarchy wants. You know, the men want their children and the families to be sheltered and protected, whereas others don't have that same privilege. So why should you protect childhood innocence? So they want intergenerational sexuality to be okay, to be normalized. And what does intergenerational sexuality mean? It means pedophilia. They want to normalize and endorse pedophilia. So this is where it's all going, right? So Ashoka University says pornography has a role in education. Their experts also say that sexual deviant practices, there's a group called Kinky Collective in Delhi. These are all fringe groups which have somehow become scholars in gender and sexuality. And they think that, you know, who is to say what is pleasure and pain and who's to define that? And so even rape can be, is fine as long as, you know, people don't call it that. And it's something that people like to get raped. So maybe you don't like to get raped, but others perhaps enjoy getting raped. And that should be fine. So these are the toxic ideas that not only Ashoka students are getting for 10 lakhs a year for 4 years, 40 lakhs. This is the kind of liberal arts education that one receives. But these so-called experts are also guiding the NCERT system to train K-12 education teachers on how to be inclusive. So the left has lovely sounding words. We are all for inclusion. We don't want to exclude anybody. But this gender inclusion, sexuality, non-binary inclusion, this is indoctrination. And it's just not coming from Ashoka. The UN, the UNESCO is a big champion of all this. So we have to actually look at our connections with the UN and see if this is really the right time to chop off and sever these ties with these world organizations who are all funded by people like China and the Gates Foundation. So there are bigger players who are using these world organizations as instruments to get to us. So the UN, the WHO, the UNESCO, they're all compromised and they're all pushing critical race theory based ideas, right? Now, let's take this gender ideology further. Ashoka somehow, and I don't know what this connection is, I haven't figured it out, within the gender department, gender and sexuality department, also talks a lot about Kashmir issues. Kashmir separatist issues. They bring in artists from Kashmir who are, you know, longing for a separatist kind of Kashmir, things like that. Just keep that aside because it's relevant down the road. Now, Ashoka also has a biology professor who himself, herself, whatever, is non-binary or a trans person and says that gender is actually a choice. This is a Harvard-educated, her name is Kaveri, Bittu Kaveri Kondaya. She's an activist and a trans person. And she actually teaches biology in Ashoka and says that gender is actually a choice, which many biologists actually reject this idea. It could be something political, but as far as the science of biology is concerned, that many people don't accept that gender is sort of a choice because we've known it, many civilizations have known it, and there are certain things that biology determines. It's in the DNA. So that's Ashoka for you. Now, Ashoka's job is to create scholarship, so get the gender, radical gender theory, things like that from the US, teach their students, also prepare other scholars in this ideology and spread it out and as experts to places like the NCERT. Now we have Godrej in this wonderful city and Godrej has something called the Godrej Culture Labs. So while Ashoka is in the business of importing, this scholarship and passing it on and preparing students and their scholars, Godrej is in the business of spreading this ideology at the popular level. So the Godrej Culture Labs I think around 10 years ago, has this guy by the name of Paramesh Sahni, who himself is a homosexual guy, but maybe calls himself trans or whatever. And he's a very flamboyant personality. And he goes to Nabisa, I think is her name, Godrej, and says, we need to start this very funky, cool, Bombay platform to bring in these diverse ideas. And this Nabisa says yes. And so he starts this Godrej Culture Labs, where these kinds of trans ideas come in and are distributed to the youngsters of Mumbai. They make it very cool. They, it's portrayed as a very high energy, funky, cool, cutting edge kind of place. Now, interestingly, the brand ambassador for this Godrej Culture Labs is another, I forget his name, but he is also a Columbia University graduate. He's the head of Pink List and himself a gay guy. And, he is a Kashmir separatist as well. So there's something to do with Kashmir separatism and the LGBTQ, and I can't figure out what. Because Islam and LGBTQ, they're just, miles apart, but somehow under the umbrella of LGBTQ scholarship or study or propaganda, this Kashmir separatist issue also comes in or finds a home. So we have to figure out why. Now, Paramesh Sahni, interestingly, in Godrej, came up with a manifesto where he says, what are the best practices of HR to be trans-inclusive? So Paramesh Sahni himself, if you watch his videos, a big bully. He says that whenever someone questions me, I go to Godrej and I come up with all these ideas for trans inclusion. And there's always this usually an old man being sexist. So there's an attack on men, clearly. And he will say, let me play devil's advocate. And I always say, we don't want any devils. We want only angels. As if, he's, sitting at a cost center at Godrej. He says he cancels any of the senior managers who says, hey, let me play devil's advocate. So what the hell are you doing? Because these are the guys who are making money for the company, right? Who are profit centers, who are adding to the bottom line, whereas Paramesh Sahni is just running this culture club, being a cost center. But of course, he has the right to cancel them. He doesn't even give them a chance to speak. And he proudly claims that he just cancels them. He just said, I don't want any devil's advocate people. Now, he comes up with this manifesto and his asks are just stunning. While we all appreciate and respect trans people and all people for that matter, Sahni goes on to say, saying that these are my list of asks. For example, he wants companies to pay for surgeries for trans people, the gender transition surgeries. He wants them for other cosmetic surgeries. He wants the company to pay. He wants separate bathrooms for trans people. He wants transportation so that trans people are kept safe and they go home safely and they come back. So you have to arrange certain kinds of special transportation for them to drop them home and pick them up. I mean, this is a luxury. I would consider becoming trans just for these benefits. And then, he also says that since trans people have been through so much, that any of the entry criteria that we impose on other people, so we have entry interviews and tests and things like that, though all those should be, those are not allowed for trans people. You should just take trans people as they are. This is a big ask. Right? And not only that, he wants you, the company, to do all this. And he wants all, not only Godrej, maybe Nabisa Godrej is okay with this, but he wants Godrej to go around telling other companies that these are the best practices, HR practices, for being so-called trans inclusive. So these are sort of dangerous ideas. This is part of ESG. Rajiv ji spoke about ESG. So this is a social, component of ESG. Under the social justice component, these kinds of, so tomorrow if you don't have these kinds of policies within your company, your ESG rating will be down. We have religious freedom coming into the ESG. You know, there is RFBF, Foundation for Religious Freedom, a foundation which is off, which is an offshoot of the World Economic Forum, and they want to make the workplace inclusive of people with, you know, who are religious. They want them to wear it on their sleeve. They want, they think that a person who brings, you know, religion to the workplace brings their whole self into the workplace. There's some jargon like that. But then what happens is, you know, you can very easily see that when a Hindu comes to the workplace with religious, with their religion, he's of course not doing anything. He's just sitting in the corner meditating or something and going back. Whereas the Abrahamic faiths will bring their whole selves in, which means they'll start proselytizing. And now the new churches will end up being corporate boardrooms, right? Because, and this is how your ESG rating will go up. So the Foundation for Religious Freedom has come up with a READI index, R-E-D-I, it's called, Religious Equity Diversity Index. And it rates companies on how open to interfaith practices and, you know, showing of interfaith ideas in, at the workplace. You know, how they encourage this. And if you don't encourage religion, this multi-faith religion at the workplace, your ESG rating goes down. So you as, you know, workers in different companies have to reject these diversity trainings, have to reject ESG, have to question what does S really stand for. You as investors in companies, in mutual funds, have to say, hey, is my mutual fund investing in companies based on ESG? Then I don't want it. I just want pure profit. I don't want the company to be doing social justice and environmental compliance and things like that. I just want to turn a profit and I'll take care of it myself. So these are things that we can do in our capacity, you know, to change and, you know, to change these ideas of social justice that's coming from the West. So, you know, we've just seen the tip of the iceberg. As I've shown you, there are many, many people in Harvard who are funding these things, not just Mahindra and Mittal's. There's the Paytm chief who funded $10 million to Harvard. Bajaj has funded more than $5, $6 million. So there are lots of people. Everybody is in it together. And when a group of them are in it together, they find some comfort and, you know, in this kind of company. There's their risk is a little mitigated. They feel that they're not doing it alone. But it's hard for us to now think that they do not know what they're doing, right? Because business leaders are very good at due diligence. They know exactly what they're doing. And if they really did not know it, maybe we'll see them pull the plug. Maybe Mahindra will go and tell Harvard that, you know, I didn't realize this is what you're doing and maybe we should stop or get my name out of the Humanities Center. So if that happens in a year, we can see, you know, that this has an impact. And if it doesn't, it means they are all working hand in glove in you know, in these kinds of pursuits. On one side, making money out of India from consumers like you, and on the other hand, they are working fiercely, I would say, with their money to break India apart. So with that, we can take questions. Thank you.